Okay, I think we can get started. Thanks everyone for tuning in. I'm Raman Preet Kaur from the Communications Department at Brookings. Today I'm joined by Amy Nelson, who is a Rubenstein Fellow in the Brookings Foreign Policy Program, and Alex Montgomery of the Political Science Department at Reed College. Amy and Alex are going to be answering audience questions about the security risks around the war in Ukraine. If you have any questions that you'd like them to answer, please DM the Brookings account. So we'll jump right in with the first question for Amy. Amy, you and Alex recently wrote a piece about escalation aversion and how NATO is thinking about this. Can you please start by telling us what escalation aversion is? And how do you think Putin is taking NATO's escalation aversion into account for his military strategy?
Sure thing, Raman. And first of all, thanks so much for putting this together, and thanks to everyone for listening in today. In the piece, we describe a phenomenon we've called escalation aversion, which is basically a bias in which the careful weighing of multiple risks is actually abandoned in favor of the avoidance of a single worst-case scenario outcome. In this case, it's escalation leading to nuclear war. These kinds of biases aren't unusual in decision-making processes, but they vary based on where you're making your decision, who you are, and what you stand to essentially lose at the outcome of the process. So most people are moderately risk-averse, but the phenomenon we describe as escalation aversion, this single risk is actually crowding out multiple risks that might otherwise be weighed in the decision-making process. It's a crucial goal to avoid escalation to nuclear war, but as we had said in the piece, and as you said just now, Raman, the exclusive focus gives the impression of almost paralysis, and it cedes the initiative to President Putin, so leaving him with first mover advantage, waiting. While NATO sort of waits to see what he will do next.
Okay, thank you, Amy. Alex is the co-author of the piece. Did you have anything to add?
Yeah, and thanks for enjoying. Thanks for inviting us here today, and thanks for setting all of this up. The only thing I want to add is that what we're concerned about is not only escalation aversion itself, but also the appearance of escalation aversion. That is to say, that if Russia perceives that the West it appears to be escalation averse, that's the problem, in that they're going to try to take advantage of that, and leaves us just handing over the initiative to them. So it may be the case that we are not actually escalation averse, but even the appearance of it can be bad in terms of enabling Putin to escalate, or to potentially try to deter any moves that might be made by NATO or the West more generally. So it's one of the reasons why we wanted to highlight it. It's sort of a it's a very specific distinction we're making here. We're trying to, while we recognize that, the threat of nuclear war is higher now than it has been at any time since the end of the Cold War, and is indeed something that we need to avoid, we also need to make it clear, or at least appear, that we are not going to be deterred from taking steps that we believe are in national or international interest in this conflict.
Thank you, Alex. I'm going to stay with you for a second. One of our audience questions was asking to please explain what a no-fly zone is and why NATO seems to be so against it. So if you can please explain that for us.
Sure thing. So a no-fly zone initially sounds like something fairly innocuous. You tell people that they can't fly in this zone, and they don't. Now, the circumstances under which the US has previously done this, most notably in Iraq, in fact, just after the Persian Gulf War, it is necessary to have air superiority, air dominance, air supremacy, even, in that it involves constantly patrolling the area. It's not that one can declare it. One needs to have planes up in the sky 24/7, flying over a country which is the size of the state of Texas. And shooting down, or at least threatening to shoot down, any aircraft that happened to violate the no-fly zone. Now, part of that, in order to try to minimize the risk to the planes which are carrying out the no-fly zone, is that we also would need to attack ground-to-air missiles, which are stationed outside of Ukraine in Russia, in order to ensure that the planes won't get shot down. Now, the problem here, of course, is that that would indeed be an act of war and would pull NATO into the war in no uncertain terms with Russia. The other issue here, of course, is that planes are going to be shot down. The no-fly zones, which we had in Iraq, were essentially entirely uncontested, whereas this is very contested airspace. Now, the Ukrainians have been doing a fantastic job of managing to keep some of their air defenses running nonetheless, and there's been a very odd sort of absence of the Russian Air Force from this conflict. Indeed, the missile strikes they've been carrying out from on Ukraine have actually been carried out for the most part from Russian airspace, which does seem to indicate that even without a no-fly zone, that the Russians are trying to be cautious about sending at least certain types of aircraft. Now, they are using combat helicopters in a number of places, nonetheless, and during the day, but most of the strikes they are carrying out are at night and actually fired from outside Ukraine's territory. So the no-fly zone, the problem is that it would definitely pull NATO into a direct war. The other problem is that it isn't necessarily the thing which would help Ukraine the most right now. So a lot of the attacks on civilians, which we're seeing now via artillery or from are not coming from Ukraine's airspace. Having a no-fly zone in Ukraine's airspace doesn't actually help us if all of the ordnance is being fired off from inside Russian territory. So a lot of risk, I mean, not just risk, if there's a certainty that this would pull NATO into a more general war, but also not a whole lot of benefits to it either. So that's essentially why NATO seems to be so against it. It makes perfect sense that Ukraine would ask for it, but as Zelensky made it clear in his address to the U.S. Congress, he asked for it. And essentially said, we know you're not going to give us this, so please give us other types of weapons that would enable us to better defend ourselves.
And actually, that's a really good segue to our next audience question, which I believe the press secretary was also asked the other day, sort of in similar terms. Why is the United States okay with sending certain types of military aid, like guns and ammunition, to Ukraine, but not certain types of planes? Alex, if you can take that one as well.
Yeah, sure. So part of this is that the provision of weapons to conflicts like this one is, I have a couple of colleagues who've written about this, Ona Hathaway at Yale and I think it's Scott Shapiro, have pointed out that there's sort of this idea that all other countries must be neutral and can't do anything is not the case, especially when you are supplying arms to the defender, not the aggressor. So NATO sees, and apparently Russia sees, the provisions of the types of weapons which have been provided so far to not be worthy of escalation, which isn't to say that Russia hasn't tried to say some things in order to try to compel NATO to stop supplying these arms, but none of them have been credible. None of them have been followed up by actions. One way to interpret the probably hypersonic missile tech, the Kinzhal, it's actually an air-launched ballistic missile, close to the border with, I think it was with Poland, was sort of as a warning shot, or as a capability demonstration, or maybe just to try to change the narrative about what's going on. Now, planes, on the other hand, so the part of the problem here is that there was a lack of internal messaging in the United States government. So State Department said, yes, we are definitely in favor of this. Defense Department said no, and the answer ended up being no. And then our Polish allies apparently must have gotten frustrated and said, well, you know, why don't we send them to Ramstein, where they can be re-kitted and then can be flown from there into Ukraine. And flying combat aircraft from a NATO country into Ukraine is certainly something which could very easily accidentally be considered an act of war and could escalate further. So I'm sure the Germans weren't happy with this. The Poles would have been very happy with this, in part because it would have actually allowed them to upgrade their aircraft, although they were very, they were good in their request in that they actually said, oh, we'll take used planes. We don't need brand new ones as replacement for our MiGs. So it's just a much higher risk of accidentally being considered escalation or actually being considered escalation. Now, there was a very creative workaround for this is U.S. domestic laws in World War II due to the Neutrality Act, in that the U.S. wanted to supply some planes to the United Kingdom, but couldn't figure out a way of getting around it until they figured out that what they would do is they would land them right across the Canadian border, drain them of fuel. They would tow them with horses across the border. It would then be refueled and Canadian pilots would fly off. Now, I'm not suggesting that that would work this time, but part of it does have to do with the specific delivery method of the planes. So that also is one of the reasons why provision of armaments currently is finding that the delivery methods, which used to be via aircraft, are no longer via aircraft. So part of it's the weapon in that, could be the weapon in that this could be seen as an escalation. A lot of it actually has to do with the delivery method itself.
Thank you, Alex. That was a really helpful explanation. Next audience question, I'm going to turn it over to Amy. Amy, one of the questions we got was, does the bad state of Russia's conventional forces raise concerns that Putin might escalate into the nuclear domain?
Great, thanks. So, I mean, yes and no, right? So as Alex said, we are closer, the risk of nuclear war or a WMD attack has increased in recent weeks. Do I think it's imminent or even likely that Putin might drop a nuke? I don't. First of all, that would be inconsistent with Russia's nuclear declaratory policy, which allows for the use of nuclear weapons only if existentially threatened. The current state of the conflict is not, it's obviously not going well for Russia, but to say that they're experiencing an existential threat at this point in time, I think is premature. I do think that there are a lot of other desperate things, right, in the scale of desperation the Russian military can turn to short of a nuclear weapon. So increasingly powerful missiles, maneuverable missiles that are shot at longer ranges, against which Ukraine is less able to defend or not at all able to defend, for example. There's a whole host of other approaches. So yes, it does raise the concern. It does increase it. Does it increase it significantly? And right now, I would say no. Alex, do you have thoughts?
I would agree. I do think that it's possible that there could be a chemical or a biological attack. Russia has been essentially signaling that it might attempt to do a false flag attack by trying to spread around ideas about Ukraine's possession of biological or chemical weapons. And in a number of senses, that's a much lower threshold. The only thing I would add to that is that the current campaign does appear to be moving much more towards direct attacks on civilians, and that one does not need nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons to kill a lot of civilians. Artillery shells over a long period of time will also will have the same kind of effect.
Okay, thanks both. Alex, a question from the audience for you. What will NATO do if Russia attacks one of its members? You know, you've been hearing a lot of this statement that, you know, NATO will defend every inch of its territory. But, you know, what happens if NATO does get attacked?
That's right. So there's no automatic trigger whereby I think it's our Article 5 in which an attack on one is an attack on all. The only time that has been done is 9/11, which of course was not actually an attack of a state, it was an attack of a non-state actor. Nonetheless, even absent that, one would expect that NATO would still not attempt to escalate immediately as high as it could possibly go. So, for example, if the attack involves artillery or missiles on territory, but no incursion of ground forces, if it's a limited attack, then there might be a limited response, possibly even a response which is slightly larger in order to send home the message that that the U.S. is and NATO more broadly is also willing to escalate if NATO. So I have zero doubts, and no one should have any doubts that NATO will defend every member country. The proportionality of the response, I think, is going to be something which we'd have to see exactly what it was. And I would say that I do not expect Russia to directly attack. It's clear right now that their conventional forces are, at least at the moment with the forces, are not operating very well at all. So there's seem to be zero chance that they would actually attempt some sort of a ground invasion. The only kind of circumstances in which I would see Russia attacking NATO is again, an attempt to compel the US and NATO in order to stop arms shipments into Ukraine. But I would suspect that what they would rely on is, long range missile strikes on, still inside Ukraine, but just on the inside of the border in order to try to avoid that. But again, this is where you're taking risks and accidents can happen. We just had India just accidentally launched a missile into Pakistan, and fortunately, Pakistan didn't do anything about it other than throw some shade. But there are things short of attacking NATO that could be perceived as one or could accidentally be one, which could lead to further escalation. Now, this would be Russia's fault, not NATO's. And so this isn't an escalation aversion kind of thing. NATO is for the most part being wise. As we talk about in the piece, most of what we want to do is avoid ruling things out in order to not communicate to Putin that he has a free hand in Ukraine.
Thank you, Alex. A sort of follow-up to that question that was sent to us, and Amy, feel free to jump in on this question as well. Should NATO say more clearly what its own red lines are, even as the U.S. has already said it will stay out of the conflict in Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a great question. An important thing to remember about NATO is that there's no automatic anything. Everything is a deliberative process. And there have been very few instances in which we can see NATO decision-making on a whole host of outcomes or a variety of scenarios. And so we're all getting a big NATO education right now when the alliance is confronted with a shared threat, but under sort of unpredictable or unusual or unanticipated circumstances. And ironically, it's a time at which action is of paramount importance, but what we're gonna see and what we are seeing is a lot of deliberation. So a lot of sussing out where red lines are, thresholds, kind of mental building of the escalatory ladder. We might expect soon, if not already, to see sort of weak link states, states that are less supportive of a unified NATO front, and or states that might be more inclined to react militarily before other states are as well. I think that was the question.
Yes, Alex, did you have anything else to add?
NATO is not the kind of body that is likely to set red lines. It would be more likely the United States in concert with a few other countries. Remember that NATO is a defensive alliance at its core. Now, of course, it has taken on offensive operations you know, in Afghanistan, Kosovo, and Libya, which are one of the reasons why Russia is very suspicious of the defensive nature of NATO's alliance. But nonetheless, I would expect to see a lot of behind the scenes consultation, which you won't see before the US or any other actors set any kinds of red lines. And in the piece we discussed specifically that it would be very helpful if actors would try to prevent or stop in some cases all of this targeting of civilians. And I would say that's sort of the primary way in which one, which we suggest that we might actually want to do something about it and have a, you know, fairly specific, you know, if the shelling of civilians does not stop, then, for example, we will provide counterfire systems to Ukraine, right? Something which matches the kinds of civilian attacks which Russia's carrying out right now.
And I would just add, I think this is sort of the fine line we're alluding to in the piece, where there is a deliberative process and need for decision making. And at the same time, there's a certain benefit to not stating your strategy out loud. And so I would hope that we'll see a careful balance of those two kind of requirements, the need to send clear messages and signals to Russia, combined with, keeping quiet on the strategic elements that keep Russia guessing, I guess I would say.
Gotcha. Thank you both. Next, Amy, I have a sort of scary question for you from our audience. Do we have any meaningful way to neutralize Russia's nuclear first strike capability?
That is a scary question. And I know that nukes are really keeping people up at night. The upside of that is a lot more hard thinking, a lot more creativity, a lot more bandwidth and attention generally will now be focused on nuclear threats, countering those threats, educating about those threats in a way that we probably haven't seen in some time. But I would say no, this is exactly the escalation we're trying to avoid. We do not want to approach the scenario from that vantage point of seeking to neutralize Russia's first strike capability. That would be incredibly destabilizing, not to mention, as I said, escalatory.
Thank you, Amy. Alex, did you have anything further to add on that question?
I mean, I guess I would just say, no, we don't have any meaningful way to neutralize it, and we shouldn't be looking for one either, because that would be massively destabilizing. There was an article by Keir Lieber and Daryl Press, maybe it was about 8 years ago or so, in which they essentially argued that the U.S. maybe accidentally has achieved nuclear primacy due to deterioration of Russian early warning systems and strategic systems such as submarines. These are kinds of things that we shouldn't be talking about. But I do want to be clear that when we say that, yeah, we should be averse of that, and the main point of our piece is that, you know, as long as we are taking prudent steps, which we are, in order to try to limit the likelihood of a conflict going nuclear, that still leaves a lot of things that we can still do.
And the piece that Amy and Alex are referencing, I just pinned to the space here. So if you wanted to click on that and read, you are welcome to do that. Okay, Alex, another audience question for you. What are the three big steps NATO can take now to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia? Amy, you and Alex have both addressed this, but Alex, if you can just lay it out, sort of those three big steps that NATO can take to help Ukraine right now.
Sure thing. So under the setting red lines, we talked about specifically providing counterfire systems to Ukraine, placing additional OSCE observers, right? That wouldn't be NATO, of course, on the ground in Ukraine, which is why we say sometimes the West more broadly, aiding evacuation of refugees. But NATO more specifically. you know, some of this is incredibly boring and quotidian. So some of it is ensuring that that the Stinger missiles and the Javelins, which U.S. And NATO more broadly are providing, are being manufactured at a sufficient rate and provided to Ukraine at a sufficient rate such that they're not going to run out of them. And so there's some possibilities that the Defense Production Act could be invoked in order to do that. I do think that's appropriate. You know, during war times, not necessarily wars, which U.S. is in, the Pentagon has ended up changing their sort of budgeting structure and acquisition structure to try to get this happen. And I'm hoping to see that very soon, some shifts in that area. Another way which NATO can help. So, you know, we are opposed to no-fly zone, and we think that provision of airplanes, at least via the way that Poland suggested, is probably not a good idea right now, is preparation for a longer war. We need to keep in mind that, you know, almost all wars, you know, end with some sort of a negotiated agreement between the parties. And even the, you know, supposedly unconditional surrender in World War II of Japan was in fact conditioned in that Japanese did manage to strike the concession that the emperor would manage to stay on the throne. And what it looks like right now is that this war could go on for quite a long time, and that U.S. needs to, and you know, more broadly needs to be thinking about longer term provisions of weapons, provision of weapon systems, which maybe aren't useful right now because the Ukrainians aren't immediately trained on them, or to involve Ukrainians in training on them now. So, for example, the planes, right? So these MiGs have been, you know, re-outfitted with NATO compliant equipment, and so they are not exactly the same as the MiGs which the Ukrainian Air Force is now flying. So, it would be a good idea right now for the U.S. to start thinking about, okay, if we actually want to provide these a couple of months down the road, what are all the steps which we need to start taking now in order for that to happen, in order for that to be an effective way of resupplying Ukraine? I think it's continuing provision of existing systems, providing additional systems, which the Ukrainians are already trained on, which could help them, particularly in a defending civilians role. So, for example, some of the counter-fire radars that the U.S. Has already trained Ukrainians on, we could supply more of those. There's more exotic things, such as thinking about providing them with, say, like a phalanx, on-ground phalanx system. But Ukrainians don't have experience with that. So for those types of systems, should be trying to train Ukrainians right now on using them, even if we're not going to ultimately supply them, because, you know, there's a sort of a long latency with a provision of more sophisticated weapon systems that require a focus now. And part of the problem, of course, is that if NATO is doing this right, we won't hear about this. They should be doing this in secret in order to not tip our hand and give Putin an opportunity to try to deter us from providing these types of systems. So there is a bit of a dilemma there. So in some sense, you know, the less we hear, the better.
Amy, did you have anything else you wanted to add? And just as a reminder, the question was, what are the three big steps NATO can take to help Ukraine now in its fight against Russia?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I, you know, our recurring theme and our violent agreement is centered around this idea that maybe we don't want to say too much publicly, and maybe we have said too much publicly previously. And by us, I mean, you know, NATO and the United States, and to know the areas in which we're likely not to hear too much. That said, I think also tightening up sanctions and kind of next level sanctions are definitely on the agenda for Biden in Poland this week. A total ban on Russian oil. Fundamentally, the project at this point is to apply additional pressure on Putin and bring Russia to the negotiation table. So those are also actions we could take at this time.
Thank you, Amy. Another question for you, and I think we have about two more questions, time for two more questions before we're going to wrap up. So Amy, one of our audience members asked, why is it so significant that Biden is going to Poland this week? What should we expect to hear about the trip, and what should Biden accomplish while he's there?
So a tiny question there.
You have 30 seconds.
Great.
I'm just kidding. Please go on.
I think that alliance cohesion is of paramount importance, which I've said before. I think that the trip is a strong signal of the importance of the alliance, and that no one takes for granted the continued cohesion. So it, much like arms control treaties, for example, requires active maintenance, constant attention, and particularly in times of crisis. Again, want to emphasize the heavily deliberative processes that underlie NATO functionality. And so I think that the greatest thing we can expect, or that we might hope to see, is a strong and continued statement of alliance cohesion. And once again, just like Alex just said, a number of other things that I would hope we won't hear about, namely, strategic developments and operational requirements.
Thank you, Amy. Alex, did you have anything to add? Any thoughts or concerns about Biden's trip to Poland?
No, I think Amy covered it very effectively there.
Okay, great. So last question for you, Alex, before we wrap up. What does the war in Ukraine signal for the security of Europe? And does the war shift the balance of powers within Europe itself, within the EU?
Another small question. So I think that, what we're seeing here is that the secondary effects of the war, which includes most notably, I would say, Germany deciding to increase its defense budget to 2% and to send weapons to Ukraine, is enormous. This is something which the U.S. has been trying to get Europe to do in various methods, some of them more polite than others, for the past decade or two. And so what has happened is that Russia has essentially caused a massive balancing coalition against it, right? We're looking at huge swings in public opinion in Sweden and in Finland in favor of joining NATO, which was, one would not have expected to see absent a war. Essentially what's causing is that Europe is rearming itself against Russia. So in some sense, all of the countries within NATO and then countries which are collaborating or may end up in NATO, moreover, are much more secure than they ever were previously, not just because of this rearmament, but also because of the poor performance of Russia's conventional forces on the ground. So I think that comes to a great relief in many parts of Europe. So I would expect to see more defense cooperation, more rearmament more broadly. The countries that aren't in NATO but would like to be in NATO will probably be banging harder on the door. Sweden and Finland can't join instantly. Every country needs to have a plan and they need to hit certain targets, but neither of those countries would have any problem meeting any sort of a plan which NATO sets out. So, I think that you're seeing a broader resurgence now. This does leave in question some of the countries which are right on the border or already have Russian presence. So Moldova and Georgia, of course. There's been some conversations about how Russia may actually be pulling its troops out of the occupied territories in Georgia. I would not be super surprised if Georgia tried to do something there. I hope they don't, because again, Russia has a lot of ability to punish civilians in particular. But I think you're going to see a lot of alignment with NATO, with a couple of notable exceptions, the primary one being Serbia, in which there at least appears to be a great deal of public support for Russia. And we'll see if that continues as the war goes on.
I also want to add that I think we'll see the European Defense Fund and PESCO projects that have been coming out of Europe since 2017 and creating a lot of consternation in the transatlantic relationship. I think we'll see a great deal of support now for those projects coming from this side of the Atlantic, and hopefully, you know, less tension surrounding the idea that Europe wants to innovate among Europeans to fill capability gaps on the continent.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Alex. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in and sending us your questions about this topic. We didn't get to everything, but please do stay tuned. Follow us at Brookings Inst for notifications about future Twitter Spaces conversations on the war in Ukraine. Please also be sure to follow Amy and Alex on Twitter to stay up to date with their research and analysis. And we'll wrap it up there for now. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Roman. And thanks to everyone for listening today.